Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and for the first part of our show today, I've got author Richard Gray, who has produced a new tome. I'm going to call it an encyclopedia for sequential art, and it's about Green Arrow. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, this book is called Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow. And I'm a Green Arrow fan. I came across, I think my first introduction to Green Arrow might have been Longbow Hunters, because the cover of the graphic novel just stunned me. And then I don't remember which came first. Was it Longbow Hunters or Dark Knight Returns?
Dark Knight Returns definitely came first.
Okay, yeah. So then it was him helping Batman in that said, who is this
yes.
character, and why haven't I really paid attention to him before? And then Longbow Hunters, and then I went back and read more Mike Grell, because that was just delicious. And I've sort of been a casual Green Arrow fan ever since then, but I'm one of those weirdos. Batman and Superman never thrilled me. I enjoyed some of the movies, but they didn't grab me as comics characters. But I was fascinated with Green Arrow, because he really was just a regular guy who happened to be rich and liked shooting arrows. He had less technical, shall we say, accoutrement at his disposal than Batman did. So I was like, okay, he's just doing this on pure nerve. This is kind of cool. So what about Green Arrow made you say, I have to write a 10-volume encyclopedia on this character?
Well, I mean, to start with, it's not 10 volumes for people who are looking to buy this. It is the one. I probably did have a 10-volume encyclopedia in me by the time, but I thought I'd restrict myself to the one for now. But yeah, I'm very much like you. The big, powerful characters never really attracted me in any way, shape, or form. No, I still watch them. I still enjoy their antics. But really, it was those non-powered characters. And like you, I had a couple of sort of key introductions to the character that made me go back and have a look. And I think that's the thing about this character. He's got such a rich history. You want to go back and look at this character. So, yeah, I had those same touch points. I had, you know, Longbow Hunters. I probably started reading comics a few years, like, you know, seriously reading them regularly a couple of years after Longbow Hunters, around the time when DC was killing off characters left, right, and center. you know, this is during the death of Superman, during Bane's breaking of Batman's back. And then they, in fact, killed off Oliver Queen for a brief period of time there before he was resurrected by Kevin Smith. And all those things still made me want to go back and explore the history of this character. And flash forward to 2013, and I was doing a podcast at the time called Behind the Panels, and I was writing a series of articles on the history of the character, because there wasn't a lot of, like, comprehensive history out there. And eventually someone said, you know, right, you should probably write these into a book. And I said, no, that's ridiculous. No one would ever do that. And a couple of years later, sure enough, I've published the thing. But the character himself is fascinating to me, because for all those reasons you mentioned, he's non-powered in various iterations of the character. He's a self-made man. But at the same time, he does have that very Batman-esque origin of being a billionaire in parts of his history. But the Ollie that we love seems to be the modern version of the character, seems to be the angry left wing and bearded character that we've had for the last 30, 40 years. And that appeals to me on a number of levels.
Yeah, the Robin Hood look was something that caught my eye at one point, going, Robin Hood, really? Because I was a huge, huge Robin Hood fan, especially in the 70s and 80s. And then just reading through your book, finding out that Green Arrow, I want to make sure I have this right, Green Arrow started out as a clone of Batman?
Yeah, very much a clone in the publishing sense of the word. Like he was, Batman was a popular character, obviously still is. And DC's you know, and comic books generally were doing everything they could to kind of replicate that formula. Everybody had a kid sidekick. Everybody had a character with gadgets. But you literally had a character created in 1941, so only a few years after Batman, who had an arrow cave and an arrow car. and a series of trick arrows that he kept in a quiver, and he had a sidekick named Speedy. So he wasn't too far from the Batman formula. Now, and the creator, Mort Weisinger, always argued, no, I was doing a modern Robin Hood. I was doing a modern in fact, I think he went one step further and said, I actually was creating a to use the vernacular of the 1950s of the Cowboys and Indians films, he'd already created the Vigilante, which was an urban cowboy, and he wanted to create a sort of an urban archer to kind of match that, which he did with Green Arrow.
Okay, and the part where there were, at one point, Batmans in different countries, that they were separate people, but they were for that country, and then you had Green Arrows all over the world, that blows my mind. I never knew that. How much digging did you do before you actually started putting all of this together?
Well, look, the first thing you mentioned, the Green Arrows of the World, they appear once. It's a ridiculous story where you have, you know, various plays on the languages of the various archers. And it was very much copying a Batman story where there were these apparently there was a Batman in every country and there was a Green Arrow in every country. And while, you know, Grant Morrison picked up that whole Batman in every country thing years later, that story was never seen again in the Green Arrow books. But to answer the second part of your question, how far did I dig? I pretty much read everything. I was very determined when I was writing this to actually go back and read everything from the beginning, because you're right. Up until Longbow Hunters, the character never really – well, the character didn't have his own solo series beyond, I think, a miniseries. And so he was always in the backup stories of other people's comics. So in World Spiders comics and Action Comics and Detective Comics, he was always, you know, a 6 to a 12-page story in there. So I wanted to go back and read them all. Now, being a huge fan, I had a pretty deep collection, but I decided to go all the way back to the 1940s and read straight through till about 2015-16, when I stopped reading and started writing. And it's a weird trip, let me tell you.
Well, I'm glad that you have managed to condense some of that research into this book. I mean, the book itself is almost 300 pages. And
I think a little north of 300, actually. Yeah, but it's
it's a rich deep dive into a single topic, a single character, broadly covering the various people who've been involved. And as a geek myself, who has her own obsessive topics, thank you for doing that for us. Because, like I said, it would have taken me a decade to get through all the stuff that you've gone through here. And this is fun to read.
Thank you.
The interviews, I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say you weren't able to interview everyone you wanted to.
No, there was a couple of people that I tried to get, but the stars didn't align. Kevin Smith is someone I would have loved to have spoken with, simply because I think he is an important part of the Green Arrow story, and that he brought back Oliver Queen to the world. And, you know, there were repeated attempts, and I spoke to various of his people, but the stars didn't align on that one. And, you know, there's a couple of people, obviously, who are no longer with us, and I couldn't get in touch with Denny O'Neill in time. But I got most of the people that I wanted to, and I was really lucky to get an artist like Phil Hester to write the foreword for the book as well.
Yeah, the Hester introduction, his interview, the interview with Brad Meltzer, those were very enlightening.
Yeah, look, I actually, it was funny because I the first interview I did for the book was with Mike Grell, and I just happened to be in Seattle at the time, which for people listening at home, obviously, you know, you can hear my accent, which is I'm not from Seattle. so I was in Portland in Oregon for work, and I just happened to be there the weekend that Emerald City Comic Con was on. And so I popped up to Seattle for that, and sure enough, Mike Grohl was there, and I emailed him to say, look, I'm in town, any chance we can chat? And, you know, sure enough, I turn up to his table and he goes, ah, the Australian. So, and he loves Australia. He spent a bit of time here, and so we got to chatting, and I had no idea what I was going to be doing at that stage with the book. And I knew that, so as a result, the first chapter I wrote was the Mike Grohl chapter. So the Longbow Hunters and his ridiculously impressive 80-issue series that follows that. And that's where I went from there. And as a result of that, I thought, well, if I'm going to interview Mike Grohl, I should probably try and get interview somebody else. And then I sort of got a little obsessive with trying to fill the book out with interviews as well.
Now, I will admit I had not been reading comics by the time Judd Winnick got into Green Arrow, but I came across his work from his young adult graphic novels, Hilo, which are deliciously delightful. And when I saw that this book was out, I'm like, did he interview Judd? Did he interview Judd? Oh, we didn't get Judd.
Oh, I know. It's actually funny. I had a bunch of emails with Judd, and Judd is so incredibly busy. And I just could not align it in time for the deadline of my book. It was a partly self-imposed deadline, but I was trying to get the book out as close to the 75th anniversary of the character as possible. And yeah, look, no, Judd was lovely. He was really enthusiastic about it. And I think he's actually spruiked the book at least once on social media for me. So that was lovely. But I think he was just impressed to see that someone had written an essay about his superhero runs at some point.
So for you, as a Green Arrow fan evolving into a Green Arrow super fan, which part of Green Arrow's history surprised you or intrigued you the most, and which writer or artist really, really made the biggest impact?
Yeah, look, I think every time I answer a question like this, I sort of answer it slightly differently, because it's one of those characters that every time I revisit it, and I've only recently just dipped back into reading Green Arrow again, and understandably after spending that long on a project, you have a little break from the character. But I think I've always loved, like I think as you mentioned at the top, it was the Mike Grohl stuff that appealed to me the most immediately. That 3-issue Longbow Hunters is wonderful. Like it is the sort of the epitome of sort of 80s books, in the sense that it's a dark revisionist version of a character, but it's also a 3-issue you're in, you're out complete story that lends itself to further adventures, which it certainly did. And I always go back to it, because this is an Ollie who's in his 40s, an age I'm rapidly approaching. And this is an Ollie that has lived a life and has grown older and has grown a little wiser and is still dumb in a number of ways, and is still struggling with a relationship and living in the very real city of Seattle. So I really love that era. But going back and revisiting it, I'd forgotten how much I loved the stories from the 70s in particular, people like Jerry Conway and Elliot S. Magan and a few other writers of that era. These are all little short one-shot sort of, not sometimes one-shot, sometimes one or two issues, where Ollie was just an everyman hero, just hanging out in the city, and he was trying to find a job because he was broke by the stage, and he was everything from a newspaper reporter to he was running for mayor, and he was just, you know, trying to hold on to a relationship with Dinah, you know, Black Canary. And that was just a wonderful little series. It's almost, it sort of borders on sort of light Archie-esque stuff without going into that sort of, you know, really comedic kind of end of things. But I really enjoyed it. It's almost a little bit Moonlighting, someone suggested to me. But it is very much like that. But it's fun. And I think it's something, you know, that lighthearted but realistic sort of comic that I think is missing from a lot of comics, certainly missing from the TV show. But I don't know if you've ever read the more modern Matt Fraction take on Hawkeye,
no.
which is which was a highly acclaimed sort of series recently. And what it was acclaimed for was having this grounded character who was just trying to make ends meet in the city. And I think that they sort of did that, you know, a few decades earlier, but in a slightly more goofy fashion. So I love that series, and it was just a joy to rediscover that.
Now, were those collected someplace to make it easier for you, or did you really have to go digging?
Oh, well, in that particular case, I only had to go digging as far as my own long boxes, which I'd been collecting for a while. But yeah, unfortunately, they're not collected. There's one or two issues appear in a few sort of thematic trades. But yeah, that's the real shame of Green Arrow's history to date, that a lot of the stuff before the 70s in particular hasn't been collected, and they're only now just collecting Mike Grell's run of books. I think there are about 8 or 9 trades into that, so they're about halfway through. Mm-hmm. But I think as of the time we're talking, next month, or later this month, in fact, there's a Green Arrow omnibus coming out of some of the early 1940s, 50s backup stories, which should be wonderful to collect.
Yeah, and I had always assumed that with the popularity of the show, especially the way it exploded in season one, that those collections would have started coming out sooner.
I was really surprised, and that was the biggest surprise of anything, going back and rereading everything, that I really had to sort of dig into various library collections and you know, my own collection to get a complete run of this stuff. And to this day, I don't think we'll ever see a complete run of Green Arrow books in print. There's just too many of them over the years, and I think the market is somewhat limited. But yeah, I'm absolutely surprised that they didn't do at least one omnibus when the series launched. Mm-hmm. But it is a very different character. Maybe they didn't want to have a bit of a brand confusion, because season one Arrow is very different to anything in the books.
Well, I will content myself with the Mike Grell collections, and hopefully they will do that entire run. But with how do you see the television show, the television series, and his integration into the rest of the DC TV universe affecting what's happening in the comics?
It's interesting, because the most direct influence that the TV show has had on the comics is in terms of some of the characters they've introduced. They've certainly, people like Felicity and Diggle have both appeared now in the comics, and they were entirely creations of the TV series. I mean, I know Felicity Smoke appeared in some form or another years ago. I think she was a Firestorm character, maybe. But the version that appears in the comics now is definitely based on the Olicity kind of combination that we have on the TV series, for better or for worse. And, you know, for me, Green Arrow is Green Arrow and Black Canary. That's my version of Green Arrow. And that's what they've sort of returned to in the comics, which is great to see. Benjamin Percy, who's currently writing the book, has sort of gone gung-ho with that sort of retro, neo-retro kind of approach to the book, which I love. It's almost back to where it was pre sort of New 52, which was the big reboot that DC did about 6 years ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
So, look, you know, but I think that it absolutely has affected the comics, in the sense that Ollie didn't have a beard for a number of years there. It was aiming for a more sort of techno Batman kind of approach. It was the series itself was, you know, sort of lifting Batman stories wholesale in the first couple of years, and it sort of led to the comic book version not really having that sense of history or identity that I kind of, as a longtime reader, I was missing. And slowly we're getting that back in now, and I think the TV show is letting itself have its own sense of history as well, and being a little goofier sometimes and introducing new characters.
Now, how much of a fan have you been of the TV series? And I guess, did you get to talk directly to anyone involved in the production?
No, look, it really wasn't my concentration for the book. There's really only a chapter in the book on the TV series. And I did actually just notice, and I haven't read it in any way, shape or form, but someone has put out a book of essays just on the Arrow TV series. So I have to read that now to see how deep they go into it. So my concentration was always the comics. I didn't speak to anyone in production. I sort of entertained the idea at one point, but I really just wanted to have a sort of a quick overview of the series itself. I have a bit of a love, I wouldn't say hate relationship with the series, but I have a, that love is tested a lot, I think, over the years. Look, you know, as I think you use the term super fan, and so I'll use it too. You know, as a super fan of the series, of the character, of course I'm going to be the harshest critic of the series, but I'm also going to be the person who tunes in every week regardless, because it's Green Arrow on TV, and how often does your favorite character get, you know, 20 odd episodes a year? But yeah, look, the season one character was a far cry from anything that I'd read. And there were elements of Mike Grell, and there's elements of the Green Arrow year one story in there. And they've struggled for years with the flashbacks and trying to be grim, but part of a wider universe. And then they've slowly let, you know, characters have superpowers in there. And, you know, they relented in season four and actually called him Green Arrow, which was nice for the character to be called the thing that he is. But, you know, I think it's a little bit more back on track now. But, you know, the TV show is going to be what it is. And the comics are still going to be what they are. And there's going to be good ones and bad ones. And I'm kind of glad it still exists, though, because it's at least that little bit more recognition of the character. When I say I wrote a book on Green Arrow, people go, instead of saying who, they go, oh, that guy from TV. Yeah, we know him.
Yeah. I never understood. Well, I kind of understood what they were going with in the show with not actually calling him Green Arrow, because they technically had done the same thing. What was it in Smallville? They never called him by the name. He had, you know, some superpowered friends those last couple of years. And then I wondered, I'm like, are they trying to combine Smallville with, you know, The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, like with the Nolan movie series? They're trying to get a balance between the darkness, the grim and gritty, but the real world issues. And I was like, somebody needs to write this down and make sure everybody's on the same page. But the show went off in its own direction. And, you know, I, as a fan of my own particular fandoms, I understand. There are moments where you see something and you go, no, did you just really? Did you just do that? And you get angry, and your analytical fangirl or fanboy jumps up and yells in the back of your head. But you know you're going to tune in next week because you got to keep watching.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the thing. Season one of Arrow, you have an Arrow who's killing people. And there's a big thread throughout the book of you know, Oliver Queen having massive, you know, angst when he accidentally kills somebody. You know, the Oliver Queen of the comic book series went into a monastery when he accidentally killed somebody because he couldn't stand the idea of being a hero who killed. And yet season one of Arrow, you have someone who is on a mission to kill a whole bunch of people on a list. So it was a weird sort of mix for me. And every other season, they seem to have, you know, Oliver Queen wondering whether or not he still wants to be the Green Arrow. And we know he's going to be the Green Arrow eventually. That's the whole point of the show. So it's kind of frustrating as a fan that, you know, some of those CW conventions and those television conventions don't sort of just let the character be a comic book character. But that's the nature of the network. You know, CW is a drama network. And you're right. Smallville kind of set the tone for the modern, at least the modern CW drama, and those various series get it right more than they get it wrong. Like I think Flash is wonderful, although it's had some patchy years as well. Legends of Tomorrow is a whole lot of fun, although occasionally they miss the mark. Supergirl took a little while finding its feet after it returned to the CW, but I think it's back on track. I'm really curious to see what they do with Black Lightning, which, yes, I think is starting soon, who does have a bit of history with the Green Arrow character, but from everything we've heard, they're going to keep him separate for the time being. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Black Lightning myself, because that was just such a unique character that didn't get a whole lot of attention for a long time.
No, another one of those characters who sort of turned up in various places. And there's a rich vein of sort of second string DC characters that I think definitely deserve at least a one-shot movie or a, if not a whole series, simply because I think they're the sorts of things that, and not to get into the whole Marvel v. DC movie thing too much, unless you want to get into that, and that's perfectly fine. you know, but I think what Marvel's done really well is taking those characters, and lest we forget, you know, just over 10 years ago, there weren't many people in the general public who could tell you who an Iron Man was. And now Iron Man's one of the most iconic superheroes because of the films, mm-hmm. you know, and that was because they invested some time and money in making sure that that story was brought to the screen in the right way. And it was a reasonably, you know, faithful adaptation of the concept. And they've done that a couple of times. Guardians of the Galaxy, I was a huge fan. And, you know, then the film came out and everyone was a huge fan. And I think, you know, that's the way that I think DC should be approaching these things. And it's kind of rough when they don't have faith in the material. So hopefully, I'll tell you what, I don't have a huge history of Black Lightning, but I'll be keen to see where they go with it.
Yeah, I always thought that DC TV, what they're doing on the CW, was trying to elevate the storytelling like what Marvel's done on Netflix, because the Marvel shows on Netflix, I think in some instances are telling better stories than what we got in the movies. And
it's probably a better comparison, actually. DC
was kind of missing with the movies, although Marvel's stories in the movies were better. They weren't as rich as what they were putting on Netflix. And then DC has this entire line. They're in the entire animated universe. They have all these original direct to DVD or Blu-ray or streaming movies. They have done a ton of Justice League and Wonder Woman, mm-hmm. and they have a Justice League Dark Blu-ray that I just adored.
And most of them are pretty good.
Yeah. Some of them are kind of just weird and going, where did you get this story? And how dare you use Swamp Thing like that? Really?
Yeah.
but Marvel has so many more, what we all call, second level players who could also benefit from, they don't necessarily need their own Marvel series, but hey, a 2-hour animated movie, that would be amazing.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's really interesting where we're at, because comics aren't selling as well as they used to. Let's mm-hmm. be honest. Mm-hmm. And the movies and the series are huge business that are not acting as, you know, advertisements for the series anymore. You know, for the comic series anymore. They're their own entity. So I think as much as it pains me to say this, as someone who's read comics for the better part of the last 25 years or so, as much as it pains me, there is a point. There might be a lifespan to the comic book as we know it, mm-hmm. and maybe the next version of these characters is telling stories in other medium. In other media, and that's exciting in some ways, because that's how stories evolve and become something new. But I'd of course would regret seeing the death of the comic book if such a thing was to ever happen. But you're right, there's a rich mine of stuff that they're just not digging into, and I'd love to see a Paste Pot Pete animated series or something.
I would actually be interested in a Hawk and Dove animated series, because the original Hawk and Dove back in the, I guess, early to mid 80s was what I had started reading when I started reading Teen Titans. And I think, was it Teen Titans and X-Men had a crossover that just blew my mind. I'm like, where did this come from? And like, whose idea was this? How did they get this together? This is hilarious and dark and wow, this is pretty good. But then I started reading Hawk and Dove. Hawk and Dove is an animated series I think could be useful.
Actually, I joked to someone the other day. They asked me if I'd write a book for another character. And I said, I'd love to do The Flash. But I said, I can't think of anything else right now but Detective Chimp. And I think Detective Chimp, for those of you who know the character, could actually make a ridiculously fun show or film or something, because it's... and have cross appeal. It'd actually be an actual kids film, a comic book film for kids, which would be Awesome.
It could be. I believe from what you were saying, I'm significantly older than you. Because as a child, I remember seeing a show called Lancelot Link Secret Chimp, where they actually had real chimpanzees doing sort of some sort of Get Smart James Bond crossover. You know, they even had the bad guys like Boris and Natasha in there. And I'm like, thinking back on that before, I'm like, whoever created that show was doing some really good drugs.
No, I know the show. We did inherit a lot of American television over the years. So we kind of absorbed that. So yes, Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp. I do remember, but I just think that there's so many crazy characters, and what's even more frustrating is that Warner owns a lot of it. They can do whatever they want with it, and
I think kids would love a Detective Chimp because that's in the same vein as Inspector Gadget.
Yes, absolutely. And Inspector Gadget, they've attempted to revive to, you know, not great success. So, you know, when all else fails, throw monkeys at it.
Well, DC is making a good move with bringing back Young Justice. Thank you.
You know, oh, yes.
One of the best shows they ever made outside of, Brave and the Bold and Young Justice. Everything else was second level. So they're bringing Young Justice back, and that's going to be fun. But I think both of them, both Marvel and DC, could benefit from going the original movie, you know, your 90-minute animated story route, or something different than the monthly comic issue, because that's where I don't feel the draw anymore. I hate to see, like you said, I hate to see the comic book disappear, but it's gotten to the point where I will actually look for collections because I'm a book reader. I'm a reader. I would like to sit down. Oh, look, this collects issues 1 through 12. I'll grab it. Instead of, you know, or this collects issues 1 through 24. Or this is its own standalone 200-page story, but there'll be a volume 2 next year. I would love to see more of that because the number of pages in the monthly comics has gone down and the prices have gone up ridiculously.
Agreed.
My first comic book was a Black Panther comic book that I think cost 25 cents. And there was more story than ads in there. And that's not the case anymore. You get, what is it? It's a 28 page book and there's like 12 pages of story.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm like you. I'm a reader. I read a lot. I read, you know, weighty novels most of the time. So when I do pick up a comic, I'd like to get the bang for my buck. And absolutely right. And that was one of the things when I went back and read all those issues, that you notice the story count getting smaller and the ad count getting larger as the years went by. I think the European model is a great example to follow. When you go to the newsstands, you know, at a train station in Paris or something, you will pick up a book that has got the equivalent of two or three issues collected together as a kind of a regular serial kind of thing. And I think that's a far better approach to kind of hook people into reading. When how do you hook somebody in at issue 23 when you'll get in and you have to pay, you know, however many dollars it is for a 22-page story filled with ads? So that's a really hard model to push.
Mm-hmm. That French model sounds interesting. I didn't know about that. But yeah, you could. It would be easier for a writer and an artist to do the equivalent of a three-issue story and have it printed as one issue. And
yes.
And I think that could actually work here if anyone had the patience and intestinal fortitude to actually give it a shot.
I agree. And I think, you know, I think it's just a matter of making them more accessible and digital's gone a long way to doing that. I sort of guarantee you that I read, because I write for, you know, a few comics websites, and I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't have access to things digitally and just read them. Mm-hmm. Have access to that amount of content without actually having to store them somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Which is the, I mean, let's face it, you know, we're all we've all got limited amounts of space. Space is the one thing we're not making more of. So, and that's the other thing with comics. Comics require, you know, time and commitment and dedication, and which is something that we nerds have in abundance. But it still tests that patience after a while. When I think Green Arrow is a fortnightly book now. You know, that's a lot of Green Arrow a year.
Yeah.
That's twice as much as I used to get. It's hard. It's hard to keep up with that stuff.
Yes. Yes. I think it was Marvel's Mutants expanding into 13 different titles where I finally threw up my hands and said, no, I don't have enough space. I had more boxes of comics than I did T-shirts, and I was in college.
No, I mean, exactly right. I was at the same point when I stopped reading comics the first time, and I think I was reading I was mostly reading DC at the time, and I think, you know, Superman was up to 4 or 5 titles because I was reading him at the time, and you know, he just died and come back to life, so I had to give him a break. But now there's something like 13, or there was about 13 Batman titles or mm-hmm. things in the Batman universe floating around. That's nuts. I mean, if you want to keep up on what's happening in Gotham City, I think at one point you had to be reading at least, there was a weekly title that was coming out, which filled in all the gaps in between issues of the main Batman and the main Detective comic stories. And then they'd cross over, and then be events. And one of the big criticisms Marvel's had lately is that it seems to be a new event or universe-shaking thing every couple of months. Mm-hmm. And that, as a perspective newbie, I've had people who want to get into comics come up to me and say, I just literally do not know where to start. I don't know how to penetrate this thing anymore. I don't know what to do. So I recommend them those kind of standalone collections or things, you know, something like The Longbow Hunters, where you can just go, yep, it's 30 years old, but it's a standalone story and it tells you most of what you need to know about this character. Go for it.
Yep. That's the best way in these days, because if you have people say, okay, I'm looking at Batman or I'm looking at X-Men, and there have been 5 different number ones in the past 7 years, which one do I start with? And oh my goodness, what that title ended and changed names, and there's too much confusion. And the people who had the continuity, the older readers like us who are reading in the 80s and 90s, we cut ourselves off because there was too much overload, too much saturation. And most of us can't even say, okay, you want to start here, here, or here for anything after 2000.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember interviewing a number of years ago, Kelly Sue DeConnick, who was talking about that very thing. She said, okay, look, you've just gone and seen the Avengers film and you really like the character of Black Widow, so you go in and you go to the shelves, and first of all you have to work out in the comic book store that, you know, most comic book stores separate DC and Marvel. Mm-hmm. So you have to work that bit out, if you couldn't remember that. So then you go there, okay, right, I mean, let it be that book's got that's a Black Widow book, but that is actually issue 2 of a 4-issue series. And that one's got her on the cover, but it's an Avengers book, but it's issue 27. And that one, you know, and you sort of have to kind of go, but I just want to read some Black Widow stories. And I thought about this the next time I was in a comic book store, and this kid comes up to the counter and says, what books have all of the DC characters in it? I just want to read like a big DC character book, you know. And he was holding this, I think it was like a Justice League Unlimited sort of comic book tie-in, and it was a really nice comic book guy who just sort of said, look, you know, the one you've got in your hand is actually really good, and I can show you a couple of other ones you might like, and took him and the parents around to find it. And for me, that was my entry, a really nice comic book person who actually, you know, took time to tell me where to go and what to find. But you'd not, and like, you know, we know there are some less friendly comic book people out there who treat it a little bit like a click, and it is, the barrier to entry is high, because it was our little secret club there for a while, and now everyone's watching it in the movies. But if it's going to survive people, we all have to share this stuff. We all have to be evangelists for it.
Yeah, the way you described that, it just dawned on me. You have to have some knowledge of quantum mechanics and string theory in order to figure out how to follow a particular mid-level character through 20 different books.
Not to mention time travel, because, you know, some of these books you just can't get anymore. And other ones, you know, you need the time to read them all. So mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to do that within the confines of a normal workaday world. So, yeah, no, there's great websites out there. There's websites like, you know, How to Read Comics, and to these really great lists of, you know, the reading order for such and such a series, like trying to get your head around Geoff Johns, you know, however decade-long Green Lantern run, or all of Grant Morrison's Batman books. But the fact that we need lists in the first place is probably concerning.
It's part of the problem, yeah. So,
yeah.
So where's the best place people can get this book, and what else are you working on?
Right, so for the first part of that, you can pretty much get it at most bookshops. Well, if you order it through them, you'll be able to find it there. But if you go to the Sequart website, so that's sequart.org, you'll find links there to Amazon and a few other places that'll get a little bit more money to the publisher as well, which I always like to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can definitely get it through Amazon. You can get it through, you know, Barnes & Noble and all those kind of major online booksellers. But if you go to your local comic book store, if you prefer to support them, you should be able to order that. It's there's a previews code for that, and I'm happy to provide that if you want to stick that up on the website or something
cool.
along those
yeah,
lines.
Definitely.
That's something you can order through you. So don't assume that your comic book store is going to get it in automatically. Sometimes they have to order these things because it is a pretty specialized book. It's not something that you're going to see sitting on the racks necessarily. So ask for it at your comic book store, but definitely, you know, look for Moving Target in any of your bookstores. And if they don't have it on shelf, demand. Ask them why not. Demand it.
Yes, definitely.
I say.
Yes, definitely. Definitely support Sequart, because they have done some remarkable work over the years. And I think it was a year or two ago they did the documentary on Neil Gaiman.
Oh, wonderful documentary! Yeah.
Yeah, so
I was really lucky to see that at the Graphic Festival here in Sydney a few years ago.
Nice.
And they beamed in Neil Gaiman live on a weird 8-second delay to a Q&A afterwards, and it was a wonderful sort of day of Neil Gaiman, which is you know, just a wonderful thing in the first place. But they've done some great documentaries. They did a really wonderful Eisner winning one called She Makes Comics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So about women in the comic book industry, which is a really wonderful book. And my mate Ryan Lindsay, a couple of years ago, did a similar sort of tome on Daredevil, and he's kind of the reason that this book exists in some ways. That he gave me the Sequart hookup, and the rest was sort of history after that.
So, are you diving into any other comics characters? Are you giving yourself a break for a while, or?
I am having a little break. I'm writing a few things around comics. I'm exploring the Green Arrow creator a little bit, possibly for an article at the moment for a magazine, Mort Weisinger, because he's a really fascinating dude who wrote comics for many years and edited all the weird Superman stuff in the 50s and 60s, you know, all the things that sort of introduced Super Chimp to the world and all that kind of stuff. Here we go, monkeys again. I told you, throw monkeys at anything and it's fantastic. But he also got obsessed with beauty pageants there for a while and wrote a book called The Contest in the 70s about the dark, seedy underbelly of beauty pageants. So that's just weird. So I'm really curious about this guy. but I sort of offhandedly said The Flash because I am really interested in him as a character, because he is a comic book reader himself. And with The Flash, you get the multiverse. And with the multiverse, you get all the really fun stories about parallel Earth. So that's something I want to explore. But actually, the topic that we ended up sort of spending a lot of time talking about, you know, the possible death of comics is something I'm really keen to work up into a longer study. So I'm actually curious to kind of look at the industry itself rather than another character next.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people out there like you and like me who want to keep reading these stories, but in the current format, it's just not feasible.
No, not at all. And there's, I think, you know, a top-selling comic now struggles to sell more than 100,000 issues in print. And only 20-odd years ago, when around that time when I was probably digging deep, you know, X-Men number one rebooted and sold something, a record 8 million copies, you know, and The Death of Superman of sold 4 million copies. And there were books regularly selling that much. And admittedly, there was a speculator market, but we're a far cry from that now. I mean, mm-hmm. the top selling, I think a Star Wars book came out a couple of years ago and it sold 500,000, but that's what it managed to get to, 500,000 books for the top selling book in the world at the time.
For Star Wars, no less.
For Star Wars, you know, which makes well over, you know, close to 2 billion at the box office, mm-hmm. Quite easily. And, you know, it's a, what crazy topsy-turvy world is this? I don't want to live in it. But I'll write about it.
There you go. So where's the best place people can find you to follow up on more of your work?
Cool. So there's therealbits.com. It's therelbits.com. It's mostly a film site, but I do cover some comics and pop culture on there. But Twitter, DVDBits, is probably the best place to find all my various ramblings and insane thoughts.
Cool. Well, Richard, thank you very much for your time diving into Green Arrow and comics in general today.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
It's Richard Gray, the author of Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow. It is available now. We will have links to where you can purchase it or ask your comic book shop, your local store, to order it for you. Again, Richard, thank you.
Thank you again.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this. Slice of Sci-Fi. Hi, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
Hello, I'm Neil Ottenstein.
And longtime listeners may recognize Neil as a agent provocateur from the Babylon podcast days. We are going to chat more about Green Arrow and his history with the DC Universe. And Neil is here as somewhat of a connoisseur of the Green Arrow's adventures, both on TV and in the comics. Thanks for spending some time today, Neil.
You're welcome.
Now, Richard Gray's book, which is called Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow, is what we're talking about tonight, and along with, you know, some commentary on the book and the topic that he covers, which is Green Arrow. What are your initial impressions, thoughts, feelings about the book?
He's starting, you know, right from the beginning, you know, Golden Age time there, and he's his viewpoint is that there's a whole bunch of different Green Arrows that, you know, long, varied history from, you know, basically starting off as a Batman clone, you know, a different version of Batman, and then moving, you know, throughout the years to various different types of heroes, you know, with the most, you know, most important one, and the one which takes up most of the time, I think, in the book, is the time with the Green Arrow, Green Lantern series there, mm-hmm. and that's one of the, you know, key parts of the Green Arrow's history. There is that time with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams creating those comics. So he spends quite a lot of time there, and the longest interview of the book is with Neil Adams. Going over that series and a lot of, you know, Neil Adams' history and Neil Adams' thoughts of the TV show.
Now, I should mention for listeners, this is a hefty book. It's close to 400 pages. It has interviews with Neil Adams, Mike Grell, Chuck Dixon, Phil Hester, Brad Meltzer, and Jeff Lemire, and he tried to get interviews with Kevin Smith and Judd Winnick, but time and scheduling did not permit for that. And that's a shame, because I would have loved to have seen an interview with Judd Winnick, because Judd, for me, the Judd Winnick storylines and the Mike Grell storylines are the ones that I actually followed. I didn't really go back in time before Mike Grell's time, and I only picked up a couple here and there, and they turned out to be the Judd Winnick stories. So those are the ones I would have enjoyed, that I would have enjoyed seeing a Judd Winnick interview to go along with the Mike Grell one.
Yeah, I mean, and it would have been interesting to see what Kevin Smith had to say about his one, which was a big rebirth of of the hero after he'd been killed off earlier. So, but there's still, you know, there's a lot of interesting interviews sprinkled throughout. And he, I mean, he covers the, you know, a history part, and then they do a an interview in a good number of the sessions there. Mm-hmm. So first his opinion of, you know, just what, you know, what happened in that time frame, and then he gets a creator's viewpoint there.
Yeah, I actually hadn't realized that the I learned my skills when I was stranded on a desert island story wasn't his first, his original origin story. That was a Kirby reboot. Hey, let's do this. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. I remember. I'm pretty sure I reading that way back in the in one of my old '60s comics, and it was back part of one of the possibly a Justice League special or something like that. That they had a reprint of that origin of Green Arrow.
Now, how does, for you, what is more relevant to you, more entertaining for you, the older comics or the TV show or the newer comics? Which Green Arrow is closest to your heart?
The time with the Neil Adams stuff is probably closest, but the I've been enjoying the Arrow series on television, which part of what he says in talking about the series, he doesn't really go over that much of it, but he does say that it's it doesn't take from any one run, but it takes aspects from throughout the history of Green Arrow thrown in there, and it's an interesting show. There's some stuff about it that has appealed more or less at sometimes, and in the Neil Adams interview, it's interesting. He said that to one of the creators of the TV show that it was right after the first season. He's saying, Green Arrow doesn't kill. That's not a hero. And they said, well, that's going to change. And he said, well, he also needs a smile. And and they said, that's something that we'll think about. Which is, they have made him a little more cheerful in the more recent seasons at a few times, which is that's an improvement. It's a bit too broody and probably a bit too much like the current Batman that people think of with the Dark Knight type-ish. Mm-hmm. And that was part of probably what they were striving for, at least beginning with the TV show.
I would love to talk to some of the creators of the show to ask them. It's like, did you go into this TV show thinking that people only knew Green Arrow from that small section of the Dark Knight Returns comic? Because he was not a dark, angry character, a dark, broody character. He was, even though he was dealing with some bad guys and some bad situations, he was a little bit more optimistic, a little bit more less cynical, I should say. He still had hope that in the end, the right thing would will out. The truth would will out, the good guys would win, he'd get to go home with Dinah and be happy. I think it was the first season's relentless broodiness that kind of made me not follow the show as rabidly as other people have, although I gotta admit, you know, Stephen Amell on the salmon ladder is very attractive.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who get quite excited every time he takes off his shirt.
So, but he doesn't need to be as goofy as the Flash TV series has begun, because, you know, that's kind of fun still, but he also doesn't need to be Christopher Nolan's Batman.
No, which is, you know, that's part of what it seemed that they were trying to echo, because, I mean, they didn't have, I guess they didn't do a, weren't doing a Batman show, and there was a, you know, so there was that, and he was, I believe, you know, Justin Hartley's, there was a few episodes of Smallville with Green Arrow, and he was a bit different in that show, in those few episodes there, which, you know, basically right in the first episode of Smallville, there was a reference to Queen Industries, if I remember right.
Oh, wow. That's digging back. Yeah. Smallville was, what, geez, 12 years ago now?
I think quite a bit more than that. But.
Oh, goodness. I'm getting old.
Well, I guess it might have ended 12 years ago, yeah.
Definitely getting old there. But, yeah, so this book goes into a lot of history that I previously hadn't realized. I didn't realize until I got the info about this book that Green Arrow had been around for 75 years. I didn't think he was that old. I thought he was from the 60s. I didn't think he was from the 40s. I was like, whoa, really?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, he was, yeah, part of the, I think, the Seven Soldiers of Victory or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Golden Age, that was part. But yeah, I mean, they have a page there from Adventure Comics, Volume 1, Number 118, back there. And, you know, they have several pages in the book from some of the comics, from ancient times to now. So yeah, but he's right there in the 40s, the beginning with there, and, you know, with trick arrows and everything way back when.
Oh, the trick arrows. I don't know if that was just sort of an homage to the 60s Batman with the goofy utility belt thing, but I was just like, really? Boxing glove arrow? You had to go there? Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the charm, you know, in his old days. And the Neil Adams interview, he does mention, you know, that's why there are all these trick arrows, so he doesn't have to kill.
Right.
Because, you know, if you are shooting somebody with an arrow, it's that person's going to get injured with a regular arrow and possibly killed.
Possibly, but with somebody who's supposed to be as expert a marksman as Green Arrow, you could go with, you know, the shoulder shot or the, what's the line from the video game? I was an adventurer until I took an arrow in the knee.
Right.
But yeah, so this the Mike Grell stories is what introduced me to Green Arrow. The Longbow Hunters was my gateway drug for Green Arrow. And I actually knew several different people in different areas up and down the East Coast at the time who cosplayed as Shadow. And they had some awesome costumes and some delightfully accurate and powerful longbows.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I mean, that was a powerful series there. I mean, I first basically encountered him with old Justice League of America comics. That's where I first saw him, just as part of the team there and in some of the backups there.
Now, did you follow the Green Lantern, Green Arrow pairing, so to speak? Because I didn't really follow that, but in the book they have this one iconic cover where Green Lantern is taking the oath and Green Arrow is shooting the arrow saying never again. He's destroying the lantern. I was like, well, right. I think I remember seeing that.
But yeah, I didn't get that. I think I only got one or two of those at the time, but you know, I think I can't remember when they did a real nice deluxe reprint of those. Well, at the time it was a nice paper, probably in the 90s, whatever, of all those comics. And that's probably when I really saw those to best effect at that time.
In your estimation, where would you put this book as someone who either wants an introduction to Green Arrow or is a collector who wants to be a completist? Where would you put this?
I mean, it gives the whole history. So, I mean, I think there is something for anyone who wants to find out, you know, the history and get more insight from the creators. It's good for both types of fan. So I mean it is, you know, practically 400 pages, so it'd be hard to miss everybody in the book.
So do you think that people who are just fans of the TV series would find this useful in seeing, maybe understanding why some old hardcore fans might have a few misgivings or gripes about the TV show?
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows more of the history coming behind the TV show and, you know, where all of these influence that you do eventually see in the TV show, where they came from, some of those origins of those. So it's good background there. He does not cover, you know, really all that much of the TV show. So if you're trying to find insights of the TV show itself, it doesn't really give you much of that, but it does, you know, give you the background of the character, you know, a complete background of the character, from, you know, over all these 70 odd years.
I like the completist nature of the book, how he did try to interview as many writers and artists who are still with us as he could. And like you said, he said in the interview, he tried for a long time to try to get Judd Winnick and Kevin Smith on there, but with the deadline he had, it just didn't work out. And I would hope that maybe someday he'd get to talk to them and maybe do like a supplement, you know, an online supplement or something to make it as complete a picture of Green Arrow as it can be. Because a lot of people came to Green Arrow just because of Kevin Smith's name.
Right. I mean, that was a big draw there. You know, this guy who did these strange comedies, which, you know, in comic book stores that set place with, you know, all these comic book references in them. And when, what's he doing, you know, writing this comic book for this character who hadn't really been all that big in recent times. And then he, that series took off.
Yep. Makes me wonder who's the next to take off. 'Cause a large part of our conversation about this book actually sidetracked into where are comics going, because people aren't buying as many comics now, not even if you count digital subscriptions. They're just, the numbers of comics being sold now is a fraction of what used to be sold back in the 80s and early 90s when I was immersed in the book. I mean, it got so bad in my one comic book store that you didn't go in on Wednesdays. You know, you avoided the people coming in to get their new comics. You know, the people who had pull boxes would come in on, it was like, you know, I'll just wait till Friday, whatever.
Yeah. So yeah, the numbers aren't that great, but then, you know, there are, at least for any one title, they're it's pretty tepid these days. And, you know, in the past, comics were canceled for having sales figures that are as low as the highest selling comics these days. But you know, there are still a ton of publishers out there putting comics out, and each of the major publishers are putting out a ton of different titles these days, and they must be aggregating those numbers together, at least for helping some of the bottom line. Though the Marvel and DC, a lot of what they seem to be doing is basically trying to basically storyboard future movies and TV shows. So they're throwing ideas out there, seeing what sticks, and who gets some interest in them, and then then trying to cross promote that later on.
Yeah, it's weird to me that DC seems to be doing better on TV and Marvel seems to be doing better in the theaters, although Marvel's TV shows on Netflix are, for the most part, amazing. And DC has made an entire line of original animated features that go straight to DVD or streaming now. They have a 10th anniversary set coming out later this year, if it's not already out, that's huge. It covers more than 30 movies, I believe.
Wow.
And some of them are great. Their set for Batman Brave and the Bold is something I'd recommend to anybody. I enjoyed their Justice League Dark animated feature. There's a couple of newer ones that are kind of, really? What were you thinking there? they're kind of halfway awful, but at least they're trying. They have
and of
all
course
these...
their Batman the Animated Series is probably the best depiction of Batman that's been, on TV or the movies, really, from people who enjoy the character.
Young Justice. I was upset when that got canceled. I'm glad it's coming back because that was a really well done series.
Oh yeah, that was lots of fun, and Peter David has talked about that coming back. So it'll be good to see that coming back strong again, because that was a lot of fun seeing all those characters.
Well, if you want to do a review of the new Young Justice when it comes back, you know where to find us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Neil, for indulging in this DC Comics, Green Arrow, and various and sundry comics-related chat.
You're welcome.
And for our listeners, if anyone out there has any questions or comments about Green Arrow or about Richard's book, Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow, feel free to call in. That number is 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message, or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You have any other DC television or comics-related questions, feel free to submit them. If I don't know the answer, or if I can't figure out the answer, I definitely know people who can answer them, and I will beg for their indulgence in giving me the answer for you. So feel free to do that. And you can listen to more Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Everybody who reads the reviews will see that you're enjoying the show, and maybe they should check it out too. Every review does help, so thank you very much for people who have left reviews. You can check us out on Twitter. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. You can also check us out on YouTube and on Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there as well. We also have the websites, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave a comment, enter a contest. We still have a contest for Osiris Child Blu-ray DVD combo pack going on until December 15th, is it? Yes, December 15th. You can still enter. We also have the websites writersafterdark.com and popculturegeeks.com. Check those out too. We have more reviews over there, more interviews. We don't have a book contest going at the moment on Writers After Dark, but that could change after the new year. I want to thank everybody who's supporting the show through donations and through Patreon. The big thing this week has been Patreon changing their terms, their fees, what they're charging their fees. I am not sure how that's going to play out in the long run. If I hope they walk that back, because a lot of people who were just donating $1 or $2 to different various creators who they supported, those people end up paying more out of pocket than if they just gave one or two people $20 each. That doesn't make any sense to me, but the little people supporting the little creators are the ones who are going to get bit the hardest. If the Patreon pledges that you are committed to for Slice of Sci-Fi are problematic, let me know. If you want to keep supporting the show, but Patreon has just become not the best way, I will be posting a paypal.me link to the website. I know that PayPal doesn't currently have a recurring option through the paypal.me link. If you would rather switch back from Patreon to PayPal, again, let me know. Email me, call, leave a voicemail message. We'll get this sorted out. Or maybe Kickstarter's new drip program will come online. Right now it's invite only. Only the special people can use it. But they would be remiss in not taking advantage of this brand new opportunity that Patreon handed them on a platter. I mean, I saw the drip announcement, and this was a couple weeks ago. I saw the drip announcement and I went, huh, wonder why they're getting into that game so late. Patreon's already got this in the bag. Oh, wait, Patreon went and shot themselves in both feet with two crossbow bolts. Yeah. Never underestimate everything going wrong at exactly the perfect time. I mean, it's the holidays. What were they thinking? Don't answer that question. I'm just rambling on. Anyway, for those of you who are still supporting the show, my heartfelt thanks to you. You are literally keeping the lights on around here. More importantly, the servers for the websites and the media get to stay funded. Yeah, just too much going on. I'd also like to send out my thanks to the geek rock band Sci-Fried for their contribution, their musical gift to the show, the theme music that everyone's all familiar with and happy with. I'm happy with it. They're happy with it. I'm happy with it. I can't wait to meet those guys finally in person when they come to MAGFest in February 2018. So that should be fun. I'll try to get a live interview with them. Well, not really live for the show, but just in-person interview, all of us sitting around a table with a couple of beers, just talking geek music and having fun with that. So that will do it for this episode. I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.